Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to Masonic Companion. I'm your host, Dale Graham. It's a pleasure to have you here. And I'm looking forward to sharing some interesting ideas with you, providing a bit of entertainment, a bit of distraction, and hopefully we'll actually be useful. As usual, I need to rely on your good judgment, the judgment of the listeners, to help round this out. So that opinion and information gained here actually serves some useful purpose for you. We're coming into, of course, we've just passed the Ides of March, haven't we? And we spoke about that last week. This is coming up to the vernal equinox. It's remarkable. The signals the beginning of spring in the northern hemisphere and autumn in the southern hemisphere, and it's that really special occasion for those of us who pay attention to these things. The sun is crossing the equator, the celestial equator, going from south to north. So in this year, the equinox arrives on the 20th of March, just a few days away. At 11:57 a.m. Central Time in the center of the United States, North America, for the rest of the 21st century, right on through, the equinox will fall on either March 20th or 19th. It won't occur. The first time it'll be on the 19th is going to be in 2044, and it won't happen on March 21st until 2102. So you and I will be around. You'll be around, and let me know how it goes. If you're curious about the various dates of the equinox, you're not alone. It's a bit of a blast. It's because of the tropical year. A measure between successive equinox, March equinox, doesn't have an even number of days. It's 365.242 days. So in our calendar, it has an even number of days, 365. In a common year, in 366 in leap years. So that's why it varies. It goes back and forth a bit. So the sun's rising earlier now, and the nightfall comes a little bit later. I can't tell if the plants are incubating under there and everything's beginning to head for the sun, climb for the sun. I hope it is. We're still here in this part of the world, covered with a bit of melting snow. So the good news is the Great Lakes, about 85% of the Great Lakes have been covered with ice, which means that we retain a lot of the water. And in past years, not only just a, you know, for recreational purpose, but a little more serious purpose, we've been watching the water levels drop, and we needed to bring those back. We've wanted them to come back. It's the world's a complex little place, I guess. So anyway, if you're so inclined to think about the things like that, well, then it's a good thing. Now, does the sun rise, do east and do west at the equinox? That's a little interesting question. You might want to find out, if everything's in balance. So on this day, you two are in balance, aren't you? You and I, we also actually have a balanced outlook. So today we've got a good show. I think we're going to talk a little bit about Alfred Lord Tennyson and who the man was. Saint of the day. We're not going to be too premature. Tomorrow, of course, we're getting prepared for the world. Everybody becomes Irish for a day. So Dalo O'Graham will be at his best. So but today I'm just trying to find the saint. Let's pick Saint Abba, an abbot, an Irish missionary, and an Irish prince. He was the son of King Cormac of Leicester, and he's listed as the nephew of Saint Abbar. And he founded a lot of churches in the old districts. And if you think these people matter, things like that matter, trying to bring some understanding to the world around them. Although we can push trucks through the holes in the logic, we can't. The intent, if we collectively, of all the ill will that's ever happened around through different civilizations, we can see. We can see clearly that the intent was, right-minded, I guess we'd say. As, there was something behind it. Although it led to collisions, didn't it? So that's something we don't always relish. Today's an interesting day. This is the day when the topic of the short brief is ennui. Toxicity within the craft, and I notice things, and I'm sure you do too, and I want to share this and see if we can connect and if you've noticed. I guess this is in response to what I sense is a push, this grinding of teeth and the tension that the dust ups, the confusion that goes on with, and the various efforts to try and correct. And I think we are to correct and improve. Let me put it that way: to improve the quality of the Masonic experience. And I must say, I think that we use generalities far, far too much. The information that we need to make better qualified studies. We need more data, and we need to be able to take a look. We certainly have enough time and a large enough population within the order to be able to mine that data. But we're not telling the story. We're not telling the story. We're talking about, I think, suppositions and observations, but we don't know if our idiosyncratic observations are backed up by the facts. And I think it would be very useful to be able to talk about to use statistics to tell us the story of what's going on around us. Now, if over the years we usually hear the the pork barrelers talk about mock statistics. The statistics, especially when we're talking about correlations, most folks have a little bit of difficulty understanding correlations. It's not cause and effect; it's relationship. Anyway, we find ourselves in a bit of a pickle. We want to improve the order, and that presupposes that we would want to use the best and most appropriate tools available to us. And here we have mathematics. And my goodness, if anybody should ever say that an order would be wrapping themselves around the strength of some of these landmarks, is that a landmark? Well, for me, I'll work that into my own set of landmarks. We need to be able to tell the story statistically so we have a better understanding of what's going on. And unfortunately, for a lot of reasons, we shy away from that. And I'm not quite clear, but it doesn't stop us from trying. The age-old, we seem to be repeatedly beating an old drum. And even if we started to collect that kind of data, how many times are we doing something? How over the past 25 years, how many times has the same effort been repeated in an attempt to correct or improve something with limited results? Now, I won't pick on any one area, but I can say that I can comment that it seems that we have things go out of mind rather quickly. So that in a generation, we can end up repeating ourselves. And the older Masons in the room will tell you that. Oh, that was tried, back this time, or when so-and-so was a district deputy, or, when so-and-so was a Grand Master. And they will actually be able to tell you the efforts that were made. Now, for the new people coming in, it's a brand-new idea. Brand new effort. And yeah, we want to, and we don't need to have specifics. We can talk in generalities. Do you want to improve the order? Well, of course we do. But we live in a world of, an amazing world of communication and connectivity, like we probably haven't had before on this scale. And rather than roll our eyes back in our head and do that kind of, that's ill-mannered, of course. But rather than do that, we need to be able to get up on our hind legs and take a look around and start to use some of our common sense. What is it that we're trying to understand? Well, we have all of that aside. We're going to move that. That'll be another show, another topic. I can promise you that. But we'll get into that. The intent, the way we approach that earnestness, I think that is a very genuine aspect of the craft. There are people, they may be crowding in, we're crowding them all into a small car with the wheels that are going to fall off, but they've pointed it, I think, in a correct direction. Let's do something together, and let's try to make something better. I don't know if the order is it enough just to try and have a futile result, or are we actually looking at influencing the way we go about influencing the quality of the experience of Freemasonry? Is that too much heavy lifting for us, or is that does that step on? Rub up against our sense of conceit that the way it is right now is perfect in all ways. Well, surely to goodness, we realize the peril of saying and thinking that way, or that somebody, some large part of our organization will begin to define this for us. Be very afraid and run away as fast as you can if you ever hear anybody offering a so-called official history of anything. Official history is in the mind of does it have an agenda? It's the first thing that I want to ask. History is what it is. It's the unvarnished facts. And we know that history is constantly reviewed, abused, and rewritten, revisionist, to serve an agenda. And today, we're bright enough to be able to identify that process. And we know that it's making it difficult for us. But we know that we've become more tolerant of sort of a crassness, a social crassness. We've also become more tolerant of deceit by leaders in public office, in part because we know more about that than we ever did before. It's making us more aware particularly here in Canada, we're growing up, I keep thinking. We've reached a point where these things, these issues that were important in other cultures thousands and hundreds of years ago are now important to us. And yeah, like those other great nations, we will resolve them to our satisfaction. But I want to talk about what I think is something, as I'm talking and speaking to you, about this sense of frustration that I think is apparent in a lot of halls. And I think all of that aside, the frustration comes because we're trying things in earnest and we're not necessarily getting a result. And of course that's frustrating, but we're unrelenting. We don't quit. And we have this framed as an absolute necessary commitment to the improvement of the order is always to try with the uncertainty that we're, you know, there's a lack of predictability about what we're doing. In my mind, we need to be able to improve that by using more data, more fact, more of the statistical story, so we can actually see in our mind what it is we're talking about. Do we have problems? Well, I don't know that. I know that numbers are shrinking, but I don't know what that tells us. We don't have any agreement on that, but we seem to be saying, we're happy to say, well, that number dropping year by year means that we have a problem. Well, truly, I can see the number drop, but I don't know if that's a problem. I don't know if that's a big, big wave, you know, a cycle that goes on over the course of 150 years or 200 years in organizations like this. I don't know that. But to say that it's a negative, I don't know that. I know that it's considered a problem in the minds of a lot of very earnest Masons. And so that concerns me. But I'm fascinated with that whole process. If we want that to stop, don't we? We want to be able to move on. Well, in the meantime, while we're going about repeating things that we've done in the past. The question that I want you to think about today and help me with is, while all that's happening, while the industry of Freemasonry all over the province, 567 lodges, it's an industrious group. New ideas are popping up all over the place. Some of them have traction and get a result. Others of them wither on the vine. But the interesting part is that we see ideas in the hands. We need some ingredients here. We need an idea, a good idea, in the hands of people that can be persuasive, to be able to persuade their mates that this is worth trying. You know, we can try these big seismic activities, but the problem is that that they may not work on a large scale. It may work on a small scale. In the past, we've had programs about, we've done some programs about this. Remember, we don't know whether we need to apply an idea longer. Think of it chemically. Are we talking about just, you know, the mixture isn't quite the right proportion? Or do we need to heat something? You know, is it the sequence of how we're mixing things together? Well, we can do that. We can think clearly about the chemistry and do that. But think about it in terms of life actions, Masonic actions and Masonic behavior. Can we apply the same kind of thinking, sequencing, before we throw our hands in the air and say, oh, nothing's working? Well, all of that exudes a tremendous amount of energy. So I think that's wonderful. And I think that the idea, that the Masonic idea is to see the industry prosper, the industry of Masons, the activities of Masons, ramp up, continue, where we have small discussion groups, we have ideas going on, but if we have any kind of similarities or connection at all, which we do, we should start to see a complement within the Freemasonic order that lodges will be working and developing. You know, think of it as orbits. Each lodge, each district's in its separate orbit. And in those orbits, we're discovering that something going on over there in Thunder Bay is happening similar to what's going on in Peterborough, or is happening similar to the activity in Sarnia, and downtown Hamilton, and Shelburne, and when we see that, the way we would discover that is through communication back and forth. But I think that we're going to see us merge at that chemical level. That we will see that connectivity, that common purpose, common solutions. We may have different means to get there, but you know, when we start to talk and share our ideas about moving ahead, that means we've identified what we think is a problem and we've identified some options. These are different options. Instead of a one-trick pony, what are our options? We can do nothing. We can try something that may be a train wreck, or we can do nothing. Now, and there's another one, and this is what I want to talk to you about today, and get some ideas from you. It's the idea of ennui, that grand indifference. Just don't care. That, I think, is toxic to us. Toxic. Be kind to somebody that's just talking to hear themselves talk. There are those. They don't amount to much, and they don't make a big difference. They try our patience a bit. But use good manners when you're around that type of fellow. You always use good manners. You don't have to tolerate it. You can move away. But don't be crude about it, you know. Anyway, it's that only that I want to talk to you about. And you tell me at the end of this, am I just, flapping my gums a bit? While, as I said here, while Shakespeare taught the world the range of English language expression, he never denied the beauty of the French language, did he? Never. This program refers to such a word, ennui, the grand indifference. When citizens are indifferent to authority, small-minded men throughout history try acts of desperation. You think you could check your spelling there, Dale? They try just out of desperation, the exercise of power as tyranny. You know, it's not like the power of healing, the power of wisdom. It's the power of tyranny. And I say small-minded men deliberately. But I bring it only to illustrate another use of the term far more muscular than power and leadership. To talk about what ennui, far less muscular, to talk about what ennui can do to a way of thinking. Before we go running off in all directions, it would be helpful to think about this. Ennui is a mannerly way of saying, I don't care. Should we know when this type of attitude settles in or presume we are immune to that stuff? Should we know it? I think it's important. If a few talk like this, what difference can it make in the big picture? The problem with indifference is that it spreads from one to another and leaves a trail behind. So, we're taught and we're expected to conduct ourselves with some grace and some dignity, beyond our schooling and beyond our gene pool and beyond our lot in life. Yep. It's not enough to say this is what I was, as a Mason, we are in a process of becoming. That indifference is when we just don't hear the lodge engaging in discussion about what's going on around. I don't know. It may be, to my mind, a symptom of this may be when there's the lodges cannot talk about the elephant in the room. Now, Is that a matter of truth to be able to talk about that? Is it a matter of sensitivity to the to the distress that that brings when somebody does have enough courage? Or is it a way of saying, I'm not quite sure how to talk about the elephant in the room, but we all know it's there? Even those that protest very, very loudly, we all know the elephant in the room. So keep that, you know, keep that in mind. How you apply it, that's strictly and comfortably up to you. The ideas, well, when we're finding somebody that's persuasive, we would like to think that we're all persuasive because we know everybody, all of us, likes to feel that we're special. But if that being the case, if that is in fact a truism, a truth in your thinking, then demonstrate that through your capacity to be persuaded by someone else. See, otherwise, it's self-serving. It's self-serving. So if you believe in the concept of persuasion, I think that's a short reach, you know. Can we change a person's thinking? Well, if you don't believe in that, take a step back from the table and take a look at the whole the premise of Freemasonry. It is about making change. But it means we do need change. It isn't a one-sided event. It's not a passive event. We need a receptive student, a receptive mind. If we're going to look at the world in a different way, change is, and Masonically, is that we look at ourselves in a different way. We look at the world around us, and we understand things in a different way. I am, sometimes in my work, I am working with people who, because they are aware of the social climate, are unable to be truthful with the people that they love and care about. A son that's not able to be honest with his father, a middle-aged son, a professional man who carries the burden of secrets to the point where it erodes it affects his thinking and his function. To all external purposes, this is a fine and upright human being. But when you have the pleasure of the privilege, I guess, of sitting down and listening and learning about the struggle, the simple thing is to whisper, tell the people around you what's really going on. That's simple. It's also simplistic, because there will be inevitably a pushback, and I'm not going to be the one experiencing that, so I can't just simply say, well, that's a price you have to bear. Go for it. The world, I wish the world was that simplistic, simple, but it isn't. So we have people that are disguising who they are and what they are for some very deep-seated reasons. And if we respect that, how do we change that envelope? How do we change that experience for that person? Well, it happens in the way we carry ourselves. You become an influence yourself, as you learn in the secrets in the first degree. And often you're taught to stand upright and you know, with your feet together, and then the work goes on from there. As we all know, we are experiencing a process of influences, the depth of Freemasonry is that we do a lot of this in silence. There's the rub. How do we do this without chattering away, making noise? I'll just say that. And in fact, some would say we do it in secret. we influence. Gaining control of our emotion is quite an interesting phenomenon. Who do we tell? We don't tell anyone. When we've mastered the demons that we carry around with us our entire life, wasted hours unable to sleep, wasted hours that could be used far more productively. That's not exactly something that's easy for people to control. But think about the influence of the indifference. How do you, when somebody has, is indifference the same as giving up? You know, is it fatalism? Right? This is the future, and so I'm going to resign myself to that future and step passively into the shadows. We want to inspire them, I think, that person. We want to energize that person, perhaps by exhibiting a balanced Masonic worldview. And carrying on, even in spite of the awareness of pressure points, everybody, we could say, could look at the world and in a way that leads them to despair. Everybody could. So are we able to conclude that indifference and despair and futility are a matter of choices? Well, they are. Well, they are. And could we think to influence those choices? I think that's a given. I think that we all know the answer to that one, don't we? I think so. Here, even on the 73rd day of the year, this is the 16th of March. Here, I forgot going on here. Is that the idea? Yeah. And 73rd day of the year already. We're coming up to tomorrow. We're coming up to St. Patrick's Day. Should be interesting. Day of the Festival of Patrick, and it's a culture, so we're all Irish, eh? It was made an official Christian feast day in the early 17th century. So, you know, think about the development in our history, the development of the ideas, and what was topical those things, the literature, the social and political and military events that were on the minds of people. This was after the Civil War in England and after the beheading of Charles I and 1615. And his son had been restored, Charles II had been restored to the throne. The plague, twice, great fire, interesting period. It was the 17th century. And it was a period of social change. So that was when, you know, it was during that period that St. Patrick's Day was an official Christian feast day and observed by the major, major Christian churches through Britain. It's a public holiday, of course, in Newfoundland and Labrador and Montserrat, of all places, and through Ireland, of course, the Republic and Northern Ireland. And it's the diaspora. Don't you love that word? The people that have wandered, you know, around trying to survive, the Irish diaspora around the world do gather, and we make everybody an honorary or effective Irishman for the day, and you celebrate. It's a coming together, and we usually do it by getting together and listening to Cailleys and wearing shamrocks and green and drinking beer and whiskeys and a bit of bacchanalia, as I think is the polite word, and we have a bit of fun. So we don't know a whole lot about the guy. He was born when Rome was crawling all over Britain in the 4th century. And he was in a sort of a wealthy family. His father was a deacon, we know that. His grandfather was a priest in the church. He was kidnapped, believe it or not. Irish raiders looking for slaves, eh? At 16, and he was taken as a slave, and he was held somewhere in the west coast of Ireland, perhaps Mayo, but we're not really sure. But according to his confession, his book, he was told by God in a dream to flee from captivity to the coast. It's like, get out of there, you know? And he did. So in 432, he said he was called back to Ireland as a bishop to try and help improve the lives of the people. You know, share with them something that would bring some contentment to their life, a collective organization or a sense of common obedience, you know, or respect. But one of his teaching methods included using this shamrock to explain the doctrine of the Trinity. Well, according to legend, he used a three-leafed shamrock to explain the Trinity to Irish pagans. Well, we know the word pagan came from the Roman Catholic Church. It was a way of trying to market the Roman Catholic faith. You know, of course, it's about a lot of this is about marketing. Wearing green originally, the color associated with Pat was blue, but over the years, the color green and its association it just grew. Why do these things happen? Well, I don't know. So today, it is what it is. The 1798 rebellion to make a political statement, Irish soldiers wore full green uniforms on the 17th of March in hopes of catching public attention. I'm pretty much sure it did. And so the phrase wearing of the green, meaning to wear a shamrock on one's clothing, derives from a song of the, you know. So we have religious processions and different ways that people, and we are in Lent, aren't we? Yeah. So there you have it. Hey, be safe, whatever you do. Have a good time. Be out with your friends and bring a little joy, a few smiles to the world around you. Won't kill you. And probably do you a world of good if you can get out. And if you can't, just remember somebody else out there is probably toasting one, tipping one for you. So have at it, hey. Now we have to get into a bit more of the work on the architecture of Freemasonry. I think it's I've been waiting for this portion of the work so that we could really share. It's getting to share something that's really striking for me. But I want to talk to you about somebody that we've heard a lot about over the years, Lord Tennyson. So we don't know a whole lot about the boy usually, but we quote and we talk about his poetry and we don't really know a whole lot about him. So it's like there's a lot of people like that we don't know a whole lot. You know, let's see what we've got here. I'll give you just a little bit of historical context and we'll get into a little bit of Tennyson. Did you know that Rolls-Royce Limited was founded on the 15th of March, 1906. Henry Royce entered a partnership with a friend of his and began a business manufacturing electrical fittings. That was in 1884. And the company eventually became Rolls-Royce in 1899. And he realized the business in electrical manufacturing become far too competitive and that a different product was needed to keep his company going, make some profit. So he had been, he settled on a motor car. It was, you know, the mechanical thing of the day. So in 1902, he bought two different cars and found them, you know, they weren't, you know, after you want to do that, then you have to figure out what the hell you're doing. So he decided to build his own, and he spent the next 2 years at it, and he built, in 1904, he built three of them. So, and one of them was, he sold to a guy named Henry Edmonds, and he was a friend with Charles Rolls. And Charles Rolls was a business guy who ran a car showroom in London selling imports. Well, what else if you don't make local cars. You're going to sell imports. So Edmunds showed the Royce-built car to Rolls and arranged for the two to meet. And they got together in May of 1904. And he was impressed by the two. It was a two-cylinder Royce car. Rolls agreed to take all the cars that Royce could produce. And the first Rolls-Royce car was a mighty 10 horsepower, and it was shown at the Paris Salon in December 1904. The quality of the early Rolls-Royce automobiles led to a rapid increase in popularity. Even then, you know, do it right or don't do it. I think I've heard some of the old boys, the old artificers, use that as their guiding principle. And on the 15th of March 1906, the two men formed the Rolls-Royce Limited. So the company charter was prescient, you know. They wanted to produce engines for use on the land and water and in the air, and they did. You know, they built they raised 100,000 pounds and moved to a new factory in Derby, and all focus was placed on producing a six-cylinder Rolls-Royce 40/50 Silver Ghost. And this is just, you know, the most, and then the rest is, as we say, history. So that was the, that's something from the 15th of March I'll bring you some of these today in British history. There's a book that you want, if you like this type of thing. There's a book called Castles, Customs, and Kings, True Tales by English Historical Fiction Authors. So, you know that truth is often stranger than fiction. This book, Castles, Customs, and Kings, is a compilation of little essays written by historical fiction authors, and it does a great job of revealing the real-life events that, you know, people used as the source material for their fiction. So, and it covers, you know, it's an interesting little book. It goes from Roman Britain and early medieval, about 55 BC to, you know, 1000. And then through the medieval, Tudor, Stuart, and the Georgian, and Victorian, even the 20th up to the 20th century. So I recommend this. If you're looking for a good read, Google, get it. You can get it on Amazon Kindle or paperback or hardback. Check that out. I think you'll find that kind of a comfortable read. And now I've been messing around in the edges of getting back to telling you about the first Baron Tennyson. He was a poet laureate, of course, in Britain and Ireland during the much of Queen Victoria's reign, and remains one of the most popular British poets. And he excelled in penning short stories. The Charge of the Light Brigade. Remember the battle in the Crimea? Crimea, for those of you who haven't been living under a rock, is very typical, topical, and going through another cycle. It's been contentious. That little landmass, you know, that little bubble at the bottom, has been handed back and forth between nations for a long, long part of its history. So while we're over here sucking our teeth and saying, oh my goodness, it's like, historically, here we go again. Khrushchev gave that part of Russia to the Ukraine in 64. So it's not like this is out of mind. It's not like, you know, it's like, jeez. And so, of course, there's lots of issues there. The Tartars displaced by the Russians. 400,000 of them were moved back, you know, after the Soviet broke down. So, you know, they didn't move back because it was they thought it was a swell idea. It's where they felt they belonged historically. They had roots there. And for them to, and there's no love lost because it was the Russians that moved them out in the first place and sort of displaced them. Here you go, we're taking over, get out. So thinking that those guys are going to be flexible, I don't think so. I don't think so. 'Tis better to have loved and lost. You know, listen to some of the lines that Tennyson captured, than never to have loved at all. There's not to reason why, there's but to do or die. My strength is as the strength of 10 because my heart is pure. Beautiful. To strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Knowledge comes, but wisdom lingers. The older order changeth, yielding place to new. So he's the ninth most frequently quoted writer in the Oxford Dictionary of Quotations. Yowzer. That's so yeah, he went to, so he was born in August to six. So what's that make him? Is that, I'm not sure what zodiac sign that is for August. It'll come to me. He's from Somersby. And that makes a nice beverage if you're inclined to that. And he died on the 6th of October, 1892, at the good old age of 83. So you have, he was at Louth Grammar School for 4 years, and then he attended Strathcliffe School and Milngood and Green. So we know all about his background. He eventually went to Trinity College in Cambridge, and he joined a secret society called the Cambridge Apostles. There you go. The Cambridge Apostles was known as the Cambridge Conversazioni Society, an intellectual secret society at the University of Cambridge, founded by George Tomlinson in 1820. George, by the way, went on to become the Bishop of Gibraltar. Yeah. The origin of the Apostles' nickname dates from the number 12 of their founders. Membership consists largely of undergraduates, though there have been graduate student members, and members who already hold university and college posts. The society traditionally drew most of its members from St. John's, Jesus, King's, Christ's, and Trinity colleges. And it was a discussion group, met once a week, traditionally on Saturday evenings, during which one member gave a prepared talk, which is later thrown open to discussion during the meetings, and members used to eat sardines on toast, called whales. That's what a sardine on toast is. Women first gained acceptance into the society in the 1970s. And the apostles retain a leather diary of their membership called the Book, stretching back to its founder, which includes handwritten notes about the topics each member has spoken on. And, you know, that's, I hope that all the secretaries taking minutes are realizing that, you know, when you're talking about numbers, you're talking about a sterile event. Nobody's really going to find much use in that. But if you can capture the climate of the lodge, the temperament of the lodge, the character of the lodge on a given night. Were people tense? Was the lodge tense? Was it relaxed? Was it in good spirit? Just a little bit of a sense of the characters that are participating. It enriches the minute books for our historians 100 years from now. Remember, you're writing history. Undergraduates the Cambridge Apostles are known as embryos. Of course they would be, and are invited to embryo parties where members judge whether the student should be invited to join. So the embryos attain these parties without knowing they're being considered for membership. Becoming an apostle involves taking an oath of secrecy and listening to the reading of a curse, originally written by Apostle Fenton John Anthony Hort, the theologian, in about 1851. Former members have spoken of the lifelong bond they feel toward one another. And Henry Sidgwick, the philosopher, wrote of the apostles in his memoirs, it said, "The tie of attachment to this society is much the strongest corporate bond which I have known in my life." So the all the 10 former members of the apostles are buried in the parish of the Ascension Burial Ground in Cambridge. And they're fairly notable. Arthur Wolgar Varel, the classicist, and Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher. Fantastic mind, Ludwig Wittgenstein. If you're looking for just an incredibly rich source material, he passed away in 1912. And John Maynard Keynes, for those of you who are invited, Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher, and Russell, and G.E. Moore. But Wittgenstein did not enjoy it and attended infrequently. Such was the nature of his mind. But secret societies, they happen. They happen. So as Alfred Lord Tennyson would say, self-reverence, self-knowledge, self-control, these three things alone lead one to sovereign power. Always that self-control. I wish you wouldn't add that self-control. You know, learning how to do things and keep the rough edges silent, to hold that silently within you and to keep it secret, to have the rough edges and the turmoil secret. That's when we talk, when the Masons talk about controlling the emotional state, maybe I'm the only one out there, but I think it's a daunting task. It's a daunting task to do that within yourself, to learn that, to be very deliberate. This is when you're trying, you know, especially when we're trying to be truthful with ourselves. As Tennyson helped us with that one, a lie, which is half a truth, is ever the blackest of lies. Ouch, 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 ouch. Guard your roving thoughts with a jealous care, for speech is but the dialer of thoughts, and every fool can plainly read in your words what is the hour of your thoughts. Now, so I'm really not able to, I'm not that clever that I can disguise my true intent, that you all pick up exactly what's on my mind. Well, all right. Good. I hope we're on the same page. You know? As he says, my strength is as the strength of 10 because my heart is pure. Well, that's perhaps why we can talk genuinely with each other like this. You know, men at most differ as heaven and earth, but women worst and best as heaven and hell. Let me guess. Alfred, did you have a bad time here with? You got a little bit burned by life there, did you there, Alfred? Well, how did you learn that one? Well, yeah, been there, done that, got the T-shirt in. The happiness of a man in this life does not consist in the absence, but in the mastery of his passions. See, all the roads, you know, these clever lines, these clever ideas, they just follow you. They're just going to bite you if you don't do something about it. Oh, yeah. This is a clever guy. There's no question about this mind. And what did we read about? Yeah, did we get into Robert Frost last week? The youngest poet laureate, you know? Nope, the youngest. So, and mocked. I'll talk to you a little bit about a guy that we know as Lewis Carroll. And where you know, a little bit about that fellow and Alistair the Looking Glass. We get into that. And so I want to talk. Did you ever notice the use of Hebrew in masonry? Did you ever notice? Well, you know, we had whole nations and nitwits out there that said, oh, we've got to go and slaughter all, we've got to go and get rid of all that lot because they're in collusion with Jewish people to control the world. Like, oh, jeez. If we could do that, all of our lodges would be sparkling. They'd be well organized. We'd all have, all of our lodges would have very in-depth financial portfolios because we had wisely invested 150 years ago, and we just sat back and watched everything, the principal roll in, and you know, the profits just keep adding up and keep it in the banks. You would think, however, whoever is thinking this, that there's some, we have the capability of conspiracy, go check the evidence. No, we're not disguising ourselves. We're not clever enough to disguise ourselves as inept. That's the real deal. We get by. We're a good bunch of guys, and we talk, and we try and figure things out. But, you know, we've got a lot of priorities. And getting together, when we get together, you know, some of our lodges are fantastic. We have financial advisors. You get a bunch of lawyers, and it's easy peasy. You know, you can sit back. You don't have to have great bacon. It's like the quality of the decision making is at a high level. Others, not so much. So, if you're claiming that we're part of some conspiracy to control the world, you can sleep well at night. It's never gonna happen. No, the world is not one of those feats that are controlled. As far as getting along with someone else to do it, whether it's Catholic or Jew, you're thinking that this is a secular kind of event? Read my lips. We don't give a crap. It's all good. We're searching for the religion in which all men can agree. Mankind. All of us. What's that religion? That's the one we embrace. All. Not partial. Not them versus us. All. Is it hard? You're darn right it's hard. Do we take a lot of stick over it? You're darn right we take a lot of stick over it. But it's the way we are. It's what we are. It's who we are. We're not all good at sorting these types of things out, and we're certainly not ever going to claim we understand all of it. We struggle with that. These are lofty ideas, and we are humble creatures. So if you're thinking that we're coming to get you, no. Sorry. I don't, you know, get over that. And if you want to go and slaughter our brethren, we will come to protect our kind. Don't be slaughtering the boys. You don't have to be afraid. If you're thinking that you have to be afraid of Mason, wow, you must have a really good life going on, because we just, that's the last thing in our mind to be antagonistic. We go about our business, yeah, and we're trying to do the right thing and live a good life and not impose our will on other people. But we influence. If we happen to help you change a tire and you don't know it's a Mason that's helping you, who's the worse off? Or if you really have a hate on for us and it was a Mason that gave blood or plasma that saved your child's life and you didn't know that it was a Mason, it's the world a worse place for that. If we added, we gave away, we didn't give away, if we invested in the equipment needed by somebody with a handicap, and you don't know that it's coming from us, does it matter? Life goes on, you know. We struggle with these things, and regardless, it's there to be done. Anyway, today I'm going to talk about, you know, the influences and presence, the introduction, the Jewish so-called temple or templum means an area demarcated and consecrated by the augurs for the purpose for taking of auspices set apart or used for sacred purposes. It can mean an area of sky or land, heaven or earth or both, as well as a building consecrated to a deity or deities that had a strong access leading from the entrance of the Holy of Holies and the Ark of the Covenant. Now, if any of you can help me understand what that's about, just send your notes to MasonicCompanion@gmail.com. I haven't a clue. What in the world are you trying? They're talking about the so-called temple. Yeah? All right. You could do that a little easier there, James. For good grief, man. So we're talking here about the entrance of the Holy of Holies and the Ark. And King Solomon's temple consisted of a porch, the house, the Holy of Holies. This was built some 1,000 years before the carpenter came along, and restored or rebuilt by Zerubbabel around 500 BC. Oh, well, that'll get the attention of the Arkwrightists in the room. Yeah, okay. And the apparently a magnificent structure. Did you know, by the way, that all of this is public record? Oh, and by the way, did you know that this notion of everything being secret? Well, you might want to take a look at how many different levels of surveillance are going on that you're not even aware about. So our sense of privacy is relative these days, isn't it? In any way, I do, as you know, I try to keep some things I won't mention. But as far as public record goes, it is what it is. We've long since that ship sailed a long time ago. When you and I took oaths not to say anything, how many of us in the past have revealed all, whether embittered or thoughtless or just a breakdown in their own oath and commitment, doesn't really matter. Collectively, we're as trustworthy as you learn to trust yourself. And that's how trustworthy we are. And if we're not great at that, well, we can use the same measure to apply that to all brethren, all people. Freemasonry has revered the temple as a symbol of what has been lost, as an ideal, as the model for the lodge, and as an inspiration of what might be reconstructed. The Knights Templars were also held Solomon's Temple in considerable reverence, and it is difficult to accept that there is no connection between Freemasonry and the Templars, although the evidence is obscure. Yeah, that's a little bit, you know, check out the history. That's a little bit sketchy there. Not that it doesn't make a great storyline or, you know, to pretend, check it out first historically to see. If we go along and we use the myths and the legends, not a problem. Not a problem. They serve purpose. But if we're claiming something that's just not valid, we need to know that. So illustrations showing the temple in classical antiquity tend to depict forms or the entrance portico of what is clearly classical compositions that really don't make a whole lot of sense. Things get more interesting from the point of view of the study with the medieval period. Both the 12th century synagogue of Worms and the cathedral of Würzburg had columns that were inscribed and which suggest Jachin and Boaz. There were therefore definite allusions to the Solonomic temple in Jerusalem in both a synagogue and in a great Christian church. Yeah. The exotic forms adopted with serpentine carvings, you know, that wrap around like the apprentice column in Scotland. Fantastic, eh? Look forward to twisted barley sugar or wreath columns at later times. They actually twisted it together. Similar knots can be found in two shafts of the Broletto at Cuomo. 12th century plans attributed to Moses ben Maimon in 1135 show the temple in Jerusalem, its surroundings, in much detail. These are all things that were left for us. In the main part of the text, remember, the extraordinary plan of the temple at Jerusalem has captions in Hebrew, even though the main part of the text is in Arabic. Maimonides' code was translated into Latin by Louis Campagne de Ville and published in Paris in 1678. So that's how long these reference points have been around. Another Rotterdam version was slightly different. That was created in 1696. So remember, we had talked earlier about the constituted lodges of the Netherlands. So, of course, there are notorious problems facing the draftsman who has to work from description alone. So we're trying to draw out what these temples looked like. The late 13th and 14th Franciscan Nicolas de Lira acquired his reputation for interpreting the temple in his Pastilla Literalis. And it's clear he knew Maimonides and other Jewish and Christian. You know, check that out in terms of, you might look under Maimonides, Maimonides. But his great importance is in the attempts to illustrate the complete temple complex, you know, over the years. So think 13th and early 14th century. So this is not something that's new to us. It is perhaps significant to record that Calvin used the term temple to designate churches devoted to his cause, not only to differentiate Calvinist churches from those of other denominations, but to emphasize the biblical roots of Protestant faith in that he saw his own ministry as a continuation of ancient pre-Roman Catholic priesthood. By the time of Diderot's Encyclopedia in the 18th century, the French regarded the words temple and church as synonymous, but church was not necessarily applied to Protestant places of worship. In other words, a church is not always Protestant, but a temple was if used to describe a Christian place of worship. This fact is very significant when we consider the honors accorded to the Protestants and the Protestantism in Masonic circles in Roman Catholic countries during the Enlightenment. Those ideas have history. Are we as involved culturally as the world was in those days? No. Remember, we were talking about events historically in the past. Depending on what culture that you read about, you'll find certain cultures where there is an active devotion expected of the citizens every single day, and sometimes more than one. So the idea of deity was perhaps keener, fresher, more intrusive in a defining sort of way. Just as the Renaissance turned to antiquity, so did the Reformation turn to biblical sources for truth. Franciscus Vitoblis held a chair in Hebrew at the College de France and died in Paris. He appears to have had Protestant leanings, for he was denounced for heresies at one stage, and indeed seems to have had contact, indirect or direct, with a guy named Ulrich Zwingli, the Protestant theologian. So variants occur in woodcuts about the temple all through into the 16th century, and the Vitellius woodcuts appear in editions of the Bible. So we can see these things show up in Estienne in 1545 and 46. So this became enormously topical and interesting for us to try and see, to have a graphic representation of the view of the temple at Jerusalem. And I'm often sort of amazed at how much, the landscape of the environment influences thinking, the progress of the cultural progress, the theological progress of the country, political progress does influence thought. And then along came this intrusive Renaissance kind of thinking about, that positivism. We needed facts, the reliance on science. It sort of really injected itself into all these other ways of thinking. So then we have, in a sense, a fact-based world. Has that done away with superstition? Well, we know it hasn't. But we also know that some of these ideas have carried forward for hundreds and hundreds of years. I had wondered at one time if it was around the period of the 1717 and Anderson's work. He pulled together the ancient charges, and some of those scraps have been, let's consider a couple of hundred years old. But in them, we see these reference points. We don't think that the reference to the temple is an add-on, later day add-on, because these ideas were predated the development of Masonic administration. It's a little bit, vague, I guess, not as clear about the principles of Masonic thought, that the principles that were bundled together and later or eventually called Freemasonry, those ideas existed before the bundle, before the order, before the guilds. The ideas had penetrated and permeated the existence of mankind. But how they were bundled together, we're not sure. Grateful that they were, or when or by who, the provenance is, it was a great thing done by invisible people, people that we will never know, people that we will, and they may have deliberately, could they say deliberately done it in secret? Well, does it matter? It's secret now. We don't know who they were. So in that way, they were more successful in carrying out that aspect of masonry than I am. I have a hard time learning how to do that. And these are, so time will allow us to preserve some of these lessons that we need to learn. So the impact. So we have this idea about wanting to draft what this temple in Jerusalem looked like because of what it meant in the faith of the day in Europe. Even Sir Isaac Newton devoted a description of the Temple of Solomon to a study of the measurements of the temple, which was published in 1728. Now, we shouldn't sneer at Newton, you know. Alchemist, yeah. Interesting guy, yeah. And so he did this in a Chronology of Ancient Kingdoms Amended. And it contains a plan of the temple symmetrically arranged. It's extraordinary to consider the attitudes of Newton, the hero of the Enlightenment, really. For his stance in architectural history was based more on his Unitarian and anti-papist principles than on reason. Ew. Newton. So, you know, I thought he was the golden boy of virtue. You mean he was a real person? Huh. Let's not conduct this discussion then with any reference to the current Pope Francis. Speaking about real people, holy mackerel, is that guy doing things that are remarkable? And, you know, he's a page-turner. He turns your head. Some of the stuff he's doing is like, hey, isn't that what a lot of people have been waiting for a long, long time? What's he driving around in a little Toyota, you know, in and out of the back gate at the Vatican, washing the feet of poor people and prostitutes in Italy, handing out money to the poor? I love the fact that the guy once worked as a bouncer. I just think that's remarkable. Like, he gets it, you know? He understands life. And he lives, how do you live at such a high profile with some degree of modesty? Well, he's attempting it. And if it is just staging, well, it's good staging. I think he's being quite sincere. I think he's rattling a lot of cages. You know that he's a Jesuit, don't you? And you know that the Jesuits are considered the intelligentsia of the faith. These aren't folks that are prone to, superstition. These are folks that think through the issues. They're, you know, if you scratch the surface, you're going to hear things that are going to be considered quite radical. These are not silly men. Now we have one in the Vatican. What's he going to do? Well, my goodness, there's potential for you and influence. So here we have Newton. We say, well, he wasn't, you know, he went after this idea, but he was probably influenced by a sense of the anti-papism. Yeah, not exactly him alone in the whole of Europe at the time. But we know that there was a lot of plagiarism going on. You know, even the idea of plagiarism was quite a bit looser than it, you know, hugely loose compared to what it is today. But we, now we know, you know, we fast forward, we know that there was a guy named John Wood, Senior, the man who brought Palladianism to Bath and Bristol and Liverpool, and he wrote a book called The Origin of Building or The Plagiarism of the Heathens Detected. And he was obsessed by Masonic symbolism and by mystic considerations. He saw Solomon's Temple as a hieroglyph for Jewish history and built up the importance of Jewish planning and architecture in preference to Vitruvian writings, of which he was profoundly suspicious because Vitruvius was a pagan. It didn't exist. What is that, a 12th century, 10th century word? It didn't exist before then. Somebody asked, one Catholic said to the other, well, what do we call these people that aren't like us? Oh, well, they're sort of riffraff. Well, we can't call them that because that's been used. Well, let's call them pagans. Well, you know, that's sort of a new word, and then we can just describe what it means. Yep, okay. So Vitruvius was a pagan, and in Wood's view, that had plagiarized Jewish ideas. He borrowed good ideas. Well, there you go. Isn't that what makes the world go around? You have a good idea. Let's borrow it, modify it, make it our own, absorb it. Yeah. But, of course, wood came from a different era. So in the origin of building wood, John Wood speaks of lodges being dug in the mountains and of rocks as symbols of soundness and the foundations of wisdom. Wood wallowed, I love that, wallowed in Celtic prehistory and was himself a Freemason who believed the orders were divinely ordained and first used in the Temple of Solomon. You know, just to, yeah. He believed it. So, in fact, we know that there was a Mason of this period who had this belief, 18th century. But the validity of this is a little dodgy. But he was using that, the term that I've heard lately that I think is wonderful, and maybe it was a reference in his mind palace, where he was, you know, storing information that he wanted to retrieve at a later date. So he saw Bath as a place where temples to the sun and the moon, and was the capital of ancient Britain. It's in Bath. And you know, the history of Bath goes way, way back, pre-Roman. And as the new city with its square and terrace, crescent and form and circus, was in fact full of series of mystical symbols, clothed in classical orders that were not Greco-Roman but divine. So the royal crescent was connected with the crescent moon of Isis, Minerva, Diana, and Unka. And King's Circus was a mixture of an ancient British temple of the sun and the Zerubbabel temple in Jerusalem, that which is, you know, 500 BC rebuild. An idea derived from the circular visions of the temple promoted by the Dome of the Rock and the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, Templar churches, circular, and illustrations of the temple as circular pantheons by Hemstrick and others. So this, we know that we get through the writing that there was more than a fascination or a preoccupation. There was an effort to link what was going on, what the temple structure meant symbolically. So at one point, a point needs to be made concerning the two columns. The spiral form has itself Solomonic connotations. For the twisted barley sugar, as it's called, or spiral column, was illustrated by a number of artists in representations of the temple. And Raphael used the twisted columns in the cartoon showing the healing of the lame in the beautiful gate, and now at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. It's interesting. If you Google that, you'll see. And the style of what he did is called a cartoon. It's not Bugs Bunny. It's stylistically. And they were supposed to, but let me see. Bernini used the twisted columns in St. Peter's in Rome, but these were allusions to the twisted, some of which were supposedly looted from the temple that adorned the Constantinian Basilica. The Basilica had 12 spiral columns in the sanctuary over the tomb of St. Peter, so they were part of a monument with a prestige unmatched anywhere else in the Western Christendom. It is clear that the twisted Solomonic form was seen as exotic, Eastern, biblical, sacred, and associated with holy places, which explains why it recurs in Romanesque columns and piers. So that, and we also see that in Rosalind, don't we? Yeah. So now we, it had to be done. You know, we needed to go over that. I don't find that, for me, I don't find that the reference to the Solomon's Temple to be that something that's really topical and be candid with you, really hasn't resonated. But we can get into the 18th century certificates and Grand Lodge in London next. we're at that point. We sort of plunged through it. A little bit of a background. I know I haven't done, you know, I haven't done you justice with the idea of the Solomonic temple. You'll have to get into that yourself, but in a little more to do it the justice that it deserves. But remember, we're talking about architecture, the art and architecture. So yeah, it does have a bearing on us, and it does have it's there because of what it represents. Conspiracy? No. You can hear that the references are to what it says to us as people, you know, what it tells us about ourselves and the way of thinking. So don't know if that's, I think that's more a matter of individual exploration than effort to dominate or to present a more superior way of thinking, unless the claim is that enlightenment is superiority. Enlightenment is the goal. A superiority, I don't think that's the right term. I don't. But I suspect a lot of blood has been shed because of that confusion over the idea of people being seen to be a notch above or superior in some way, when in fact their interests lie in such an opposite direction. But we're at the point where we've climbed our way up through history of the Enlightenment with the help of Margaret C. Jacob, the professor, on Freemasonry and politics in the 18th century. So we need to be able to plunge forward, I think. How are we doing for time? Everything's going along okay? I'm glad to hear that. It's a lot, you know. It's a lot to learn. It's a lot to go over, and it's like little bits and pieces that I hope you piece together and fit together in your own thinking. I don't think the idea of paths is the most productive way of approaching these so-called journeys. Journey of imagination that compels us. Stretch out your imagination, and is that a path or is that a presence? You have a state of mind, an imaginative, open, receptive state of mind, and now you explore. So you get little snippets and pieces of history. Remember to sort out the opinion from things that are validated with fact, because the facts that our scholars are finding in the 21st century are helping us to rewrite parts of history, not revise, but to rewrite, to help us explain some of the conjecture that was necessary when we didn't have enough fact to explain events that went on in our world. So, you know, be able to piece together these things for you in your own mind, in your own way. That I think is some of the unspoken nature of Freemasonry. A journey, more I think a lesson than a journey. I think it's more fitting to say to an entered apprentice, you know, we wish you well on your journey. Well, I never quite got that. I never quite got that. I didn't have a real clue when it was said to me. I had no clue what the hell that was to this day. But if you had said to me, you know, we hope your lessons go well, for me, Masonically, that would have been opening up an enormous door very early on. And I don't have a Masonic career. It's a way of thinking. This isn't a career. It's not external to me. It's part of me. So when I don't want to talk about Masonic career and a journey as if something that I'm doing. This is about something I am being. Journey, pathways, it's about lessons. understanding, search, you know, exploration, imagination. If you had said to me at the door, if you apply your imagination and open your mind, read about history, listen to scholars, sort out the difference between opinion and fact, you'll begin to understand the world that that as it was in days gone by, and that will help you to define who you are and what you are today. What you do, nobody's going to tamper with that. Does that struggle make you a better person? I don't know if it has to do with better or worse. I think it has to do with ability. Some people do that, and a lot of people do that, but in different ways. And it's not a matter of whether you have a coin in your pocket. Most of the things that we do don't require a coin. If we're looking at everything in terms of what gain it generates, man, we're really limiting ourselves. Let's go back and talk about this idea of constitutional lodges and the strength, the protections that came about historically. And if ever we needed those protections, you and I are able to practice and study within the confines of masonry because of the protections of our Grand Lodge. We want to go and open up that work. Go ahead. You know, nothing's to stop you, but it's been done. And it's been done in depth, been done for very valid reasons. And it isn't simplistic, but it is simple. It's done to protect. And it protects our interests. Now, do you and I appreciate what that is? Only if you see the threat. And my goodness, can you imagine what the order would be like if we were free-floating through time, space, and everything was on the table all the time? I think that would be very, very a difficult environment to understand. So let's talk, let's help explore a bit more about the roots of constitutional Freemasonry and see what it teaches us, see what it tells us about today. We're talking here about a fellow by the name of Rousset, Le Chevalier Rousset de Missy, M-I-S-S-Y. He was with the Académie de Plessis, and that's where he studied him. And we were looking into his private correspondence with a fellow by the name of Schroeder in early 1755, that Rousset discussed the form that their reconstituted lodge should take. Remember? This is, it'll come back to you. Rousset was a very political, highly educated man who was immensely well-read and prolific. And his introduction and notes to Locke's test, you've all read John Locke, I presume, L-O-C-K-E, yes, okay, and understood it as scholars. If you have, can you write to me and tell me? In his introduction, he notes that Locke's texts are insightful and original, and they place Locke in a political tradition that Rousset identifies as Republican. You know, I don't mind the idea of accountability, the state, the government being accountable to the people. That's a Republican. You know. The French, yeah, yeah. If we don't like it, it's us. We'll go and change it. And the American, yeah. We have this passive kind of system that we have here in Canada. If we tinker with it, the pundits, the adherents to this system always bring up the chaos of Italy. Oh, if we, you know, there's this kind of slumber that we're in here, or there will be the chaos of Italy. Whoa, well, no, Italy has a different history. And it's even going through reform, looking at how to stabilize the country from that chaotic fragmentation. It was really curious coalitions. To think that that's the alternative to this is just Childish, just a childish. While present-day interpreters of Locke would most universally deny him a place in the body of political thought, it is not so clear that 18th century continental reformers and opponents of absolutism would have agreed. For one thing, the French translation of Locke, widely available on the continent, while Rousset was simply re-editing, translated the English words commonwealth and community as republic. In the context of various continental ancien regimes, Locke's text was associated with subversion. Consequently, the distinction between constitutionalism and republicanism was blurred. Here's a guy that's really, anyway, if not obliterated. It should also be remembered that from the 1750s on, Locke had been widely claimed by English Freemasons as one of their own. The set of circumstances now permits the 1755 edition of Locke to achieve a historical importance even beyond that what it may have meant to Rousset and his brothers. For example, it is almost certainly the edition of Locke that the young Jean-Jacques Rousseau read, well-known philosopher, complete with Rousset's preface, which argued that for Locke's relevance to a republic. In addition, the 1755 edition was the most widely reprinted edition of Locke in continental Europe right up to and during the French Revolution. What then, in 1755, did it have to do with Le Bien Ami? Remember the lodge? Struggling? There first? That kind of thinking? What did the edition have to do with the political situation prevailing in the Dutch Republic? An analysis of this French translation of Locke's text, as well as a look at Rousset's new preface and the notes to it, helps us provide answers to those questions. The original translation by the Huguenot refugee David Mazel was done in 1691 when England and the Dutch Republic were allied in their war against France. Mazel's French translation left out Locke's own preface, the whole of the first treatise, and the opening chapter of the second. Also, all the chapters were renumbered. Mazel's translation brought subtle but important alterations to the original language of Locke's text. In general, they had the effect of somewhat radicalizing Locke's message. A few examples illustrate this transformation. Locke says that the king may, quote, do to all his subject whatever he pleases. Mazel translated the passage and then added the following phrase that in phrase added to the original, Mazel was introduced the concept of opposition. Elsewhere in the translation, Locke is made to be a much more overt opponent of absolutism of Louis XIV. When Mazel translates the quote, the violence and oppression of absolute power as la violence et l'oppression du gouverneur absolu. So it's the governor. Instead of absolute power, he's talking about the governor. A personalization of absolutism. So this is how Mazel sort of twisted a little bit of what Locke had to say. He made Locke into a defender of republics. Rousset makes it clear that his prescriptions for good government are especially needed at this moment. So now we see that the wording of the ideas of a philosopher have been modified through translation. So what people were reading and believing was valid was the actual thoughts of John Locke were variations on the theme. And today you and I can sit here and look at and examine how, not only what was done, but how and who. So are we any less prone to this kind of thing today? I tend to think not. We have to be aware of our need to validate what it is that we're reading. We usually do that by cross-references. You know, if we read something and it's striking or startling, yes, I like to jump up on the bandwagon and be excited about these new truths, but often when I start to search out cross-references, I find that it's not exactly valid, but, you know, it's a context. It helps me to understand. It helps us to understand. So Locke's treatise was never simply or even primarily a call to arms. He's not saying, well, you know, the only thing we can do about absolutism is just, you know, arm ourselves and go have at it. Nor does it vest a direct governing power with the people, who do, according to Locke, possess ultimate sovereignty. All those failings to move in the direction of a more radically democratic concept of government undoubtedly struck Jean-Jacques Rousseau, among other readers, when in the mid-70s he looked to Locke to justify and elaborate upon his own understandings of popular sovereignty. Perhaps Rousseau was even more disappointed with what he found in the 1755 edition of the Moselle translation, presuming that he did first encounter Locke in this version because of its preface. You know, Moselle just left it out. Eh? There he would have found language intended by Rousset de Messie to weigh the Republican appetite, to whet the Republican appetite, but a text that failed to live up to what may be expected of all the citizens of a republic. But there is plenty in Locke's text that was consonant with other progressive, occasionally radical reformers. So don't worry about that. Was it considered radical? Yeah. So in the household rules adopted by Le Bien-Aimé, to which all brothers gave their consent, the emphasis in late 1754 is on obedience and order within the lodge. All brethren are expected to have a thorough grounding in the rules of the lodge, to put their signature to them, to make regular and substantial payments to the lodge, to give respect at all times to the master who is permitted 2 votes on all matters, and to other elected officers. They must not speak out of turn or raise contentious matters in religion or statecraft. Officers whose conduct is also strictly prescribed by the rules of the lodge are responsible that everything in the lodge be held in good order. This should remain in place. These rules conform to the spirit of Rousset's instructions to Schroeder. Create a lodge, he urged, that would repudiate the drifting away from adherence to these to the good order. Remember, the idea of good order is to put your needs aside for the good order of the and stability of the lodge. And he begs that the new lodge be loyal to the English constitution, that it be in effect a constitutionally governed society. When Rousset, and that means that we're accepting that the authenticity and validity of law, you know, the Constitution. So we put that first. The betterment of the lodge is first before you and me. What Rousset wants, though, is a true and legitimate English lodge, exempt from all the impertinent French additions. We are never fully informed as to what these corrupting additions may have been. The only one mentioned is excessive drinking, perhaps linked in Rousset's mind with the meaninglessness of what he calls galanterie. Yet by the 1770s, that term is used in French Freemasonry, was associated with a willingness to endorse lodges for both men and women. As we shall see, at least one mixed-gender lodge existed in The Hague in 1751. It is possible that in using the term, Rousset had such lodges in mind, but if he does, they are associated with all sorts of deviations from true Masonic Masonry. Funny how we find that, huh? A reference to mixed gender. We saw it, so this idea that it can't happen or it hasn't happened, we have to qualify that. He sought to control the minute details of social behavior in the lodge, did Rousset, wishing, as he says in his letter to Schroeder, even to limit drinking to 1 bottle of wine per member per meeting. So, for those who are prone to thinking that everybody is, just wailed, well, not necessarily, but that's the limit. Eh? We consider that a reasonable limit, yeah. If you want to, over the course of a long night, finish a bottle of wine, I guess. You know, how many hours would it take? Clearly, the lodge, as a truly constitutional society, was not to be simply a place of order, harmony, and sobriety. It was also intended to teach civility and good manners, a code of conduct appropriate to men who associate freely, and as the Constitution say, upon the level. In perhaps his most important instruction, Rousset begs Schroeder to limit the lodge to about 25 members. Anything else is confusion, as was the case of the original pre-1749 lodge, which had swollen to 93 members. We cannot help but be reminded here of the timeless discussion in European political thought about the size permissible for the true republic. In seeking to show the relationship between the orderly government sought for the lodge and the spirit, if not better, of Locke's text, it is, as it was presented in Rousset's edition, we should also look at the annotations he provided. These were learned references to Cumberland, Pufendorf, and Montesquieu, all regarded by the editor as natural law theorists. In one passage, he speaks of the right of the state of nature to avenge a wrongdoing. Natural law. He makes reference to Noah and the master of nature is in Masonic language, hence relating Locke's ideas to the Masonic myth of Noah. According to the 1738 edition of Anderson's Constitution, the Noachiah idea, the sons of Noah, was the first name of Masons according to some old traditions. And a Mason is obliged by his tenure to observe the moral law as a true Noachidi. Interesting. The theme of Noah. It is also necessary that all agree in the three great articles of Noah, enough to preserve the cement of the lodge. In the note affixed to Locke's discussion of self-preservation, Rousset endows the first Masons, the sons of Noah, with an intuitive understanding of the necessity for the contract and understanding given by the master of nature. And this note complements others which explain to the reader that passive obedience is not in the laws of nature, and that Locke never wished to abolish the right of resistance. And in another note of clarification reminiscent of Rousset's almost obsessive concern to prevent license in his lodge, Rousset adds his approval of Locke's insistence that, to quote the English text, freedom of men under government is to have a standing rule to live by, common to everyone in that society, and made by the legislative power erected to it. So, we have the influence of the English, huh?
Yeah.
But do you see, are you able, are we seeing here the what was going on in the Netherlands with a strict, you know, effort, a focus on strengthening or the clarifying the notions of a constitutional society, we see the subtext, the idea of obedience and order. What I liked here, and I wonder if this spoke to you too, is about the size of a lodge. We'll get into that. We're getting through Jacob's treatise rather nicely. But think about it. They're saying that Rousset is saying 25. What do you think? It begins to make sense because in a roundabout kind of way, that we, when we're looking at a count, say, well, what proportion, you know, are you always that conjecture, what's a successful lodge? Well, a successful lodge is a lodge over 100 members. Well, I don't consider a lodge being successful because of the size of the membership. I don't. The activity of a lodge, well, I don't think that that's necessarily, oh, you know, if we're not doing ritual, there's nothing else to do. that's a condemnation of a lot. That's like dark matter. You know, there's only what we can see, the ritual, and anything that we can't see doesn't exist. Well, I think the physicists out there in the audience are pointing out that there is more matter, dark matter, in existence. And we can't, you know, where is it? What is it? Well, we know it exists. More of that than what we can see, what we can experience, what we can perceive. So the dark matter of a lodge is what this, you know, we have, it's not a half-baked idea. Think about it. When you're looking at a lodge that's well attended, and you tell me that, you know, we usually get 20 members or 25 members, I would say, fine, you know, that's, you know, the officers plus, you know, 10 or 15 people. Oh, yeah. That gets us around that 25 mark, doesn't it? And when I share with you that, you know, if we're going to have any kind of in-depth kind of conversation, you really have to do it in small groups. You can't have in-depth conversation unless you're really well-schooled, and which most of us aren't. You know, it's not like we're sitting there looking at the over the railing at the Cambridge Debating Society, so we learn how to do it. Well, we don't have that kind of advantage. We have to, so we don't, we're not schooled before we perform, or allowed to perform. So, but the natural balance, if you and I look candidly at the natural balance, isn't it about 30 or 40 people in that number? And it then cap it. Now, is that too harsh? I don't mean to speak out of turn. Is that too harsh? And then from there, does that foster more of the kind of things that we're looking for, the experience. When you don't have ritual, if you're not doing, you know, boosting up your members' numbers, and in fact, do a lot of those people come out? Well, it's sort of like we're using the ritual to stay busy because we don't know what else to do. Man, is that what Freemasonry's come to? I must have added up something wrong in that logic. You know, more numbers is better, but they don't show up. Or we have to create activities. Well, because if we're not doing ritual, what else would we do? We don't know. Well, what else we would do is the actual, you know, the heart and soul of Freemasonry, the discussion. And, you know, if it's 3 or 4 years before we need to do an initiation, then get it up. Get it up. Do the work. I think that's an interesting kind of way of Rousset's talking to us about the size of a lodge. And something worth exploring for ourselves. Huh? That could be quite painful for us in these days and age. The history of the world in glasses. We're going to get into that again, if you don't mind. And the earliest is, so we'll just wrap this up today. And what did I want? I wanted to talk about the Order of the Golden and Rosy Cross. That was a bit of existence, an esoteric cult group, sort of Freemasonry and Rosicruciana, and that kind of hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. You know, those are the roots of that. But we'll have to come back to that. But I want to talk about beer. Especially on the, we're heading out to St. Patrick's Day, have a tip one for me, if you don't mind, and I'll do the same for you. Earliest written documents, your origins of writing, remember Sumerian wage lists and tax receipts in which the symbol for beer, a clay vessel with, diagonal linear markers drawn on the side, is one of the most common words, along with the symbols for grain and textiles and livestock. And that's because writing was originally invented to record the collection and distribution of grain, beer, bread, and other goods. It arose as a natural extension of the Neolithic custom of using tokens to account for contributions to a communal storehouse. Yeah, indeed, Sumerian society was a logical continuation of Neolithic social structures, but on a far, far larger scale. The culmination of thousands of years of increasing economic and cultural complexity. Just as the chieftain of a Neolithic village collected surplus food. The priests of the Sumerian cities collected surplus barley and wheat, sheep, and textiles.
Yeah.
Officially, these goods were offerings to the gods, but in practice, they were compulsory taxes that were consumed by the temple bureaucracy or traded for other goods and services.
Yeah.
And the priest could, for example, pay for the maintenance of irrigation systems and the construction of public buildings by handing out rations of beer and bread. I like that. I like that. This elaborate system gave the temple direct control over much of the economy. Whether this resulted in a redistributive nirvana or a form of ancient socialism in which the state provided for everyone or is an exploitative regime of near slavery, we can't really say. You don't want to think, oh, it was back then, it must have been malevolent, and these people had sinister motivations. We don't know that. But it seems to have arisen in response to the unpredictable nature of the Mesopotamian environment. There was little rain, and the flooding of the Tigris and Euphrates was erratic. So agriculture depended on the use of carefully maintained communal irrigation systems, and the Sumerians believed on making the appropriate offerings to the local gods. Both these tasks were handled by the priesthood as villages grew into towns and cities. More and more power was concentrated into their hands. The simple storehouses of the Neolithic period became elaborate temples or ziggurats built on raised step platforms. You know, that's like the pyramid that has steps. It looks like from a distance like there are steps around the ziggurats. The numerous rival city-states arose, each with its own residential god, and each ruled by an elite priesthood that maintained the agricultural economy and lived off the surplus it produced. Carvings depict them wearing beards, long kilts, and round headdresses, and drinking beer from large pots through long straws. For all of this to work, the priests and their subjects needed to be able to record what they had taken in and paid out. Tax receipts were initially kept in the form of tokens within clay envelopes. These were hollow shells of clay called the boule, which several tokens rattling around inside. Tokens of different shapes were used to represent standard amounts of grain and textiles or individual cattle. When goods were presented at the temple, the corresponding tokens were placed in a clay envelope, and the tax collector and taxpayer would both impress the envelope's wet clay with their personal signature seals to signify that the envelope's contents accurately reflected the tax paid. The envelope was then stored in the temple archive. It soon became clear, however, that an easier way to achieve the same result was to use a tablet of wet clay and to press the tokens into it to make different shape impressions signifying barley and cattle and so on. The signature seals could then be applied to this tablet when it was baked in the sun to keep everything permanent. Tokens were no longer needed. Their impressions would do instead. So gradually, tokens were abandoned altogether in the favor of pictograms scratched into the clay. Are you boys telling me that our coins are going to be not useful, that tokens aren't going to be useful? We're going to replace them with some other form of representation that's easier to handle? Oh, my. And here I am still upset about the penny. Some pictograms came to stand as direct representations for physical goods, while other combinations of indentation stood for abstract concepts such as numbers. The oldest written documents, dating around 3400 BC from the city of Uruk, are small flat tablets of clay that fit comfortably into the palm of one hand. They're commonly divided into columns and then subdivided into rectangles by straight lines. Each compartment contains a group of symbols, some made by pressing tokens into the clay and others scratched using the stylus. Although these symbols are read from left to right and top to bottom, in all other respects, this early script is utterly unlike modern writing and can only be read by specialists. But look closely, and the pictogram for beer, a jar on its side with diagonal linear markings inside, is easy to spot. Son of a gun, it is. It appears in wage lists, in administrative documents, and in word lists written by scribes in training, which include dozens of brewing terms. Many tablets consist of lists of names, next to each of which is the indication beer or bread for a day, which was a standard wage issued by the temple. Beer and bread. Mm. A modern analysis of Mesopotamian ration texts found that the standard issue of bread, beer, dates, and onions, sometimes supplemented with meat or fish, and with additional vegetables such as chickpeas, lentils, turnips, and beans, provided a nutritious and balanced diet. Dates provided vitamin A, beer provided vitamin B, onions provided vitamin C, and the ration as a whole provided 3,500 to 4,000 calories, in line with modern recommendations for adult consumption. This suggests that state rations were not just occasional handouts, but were the primary source of food for many people. So there we have it. It's been great. I have to split. I've got things to do. So do you. Preparations. I have to put in a set of taps and do some household chores around here. I hope that this has been useful. I found the topics today, were heavy lifting for me. The getting into Solomon's temple and the depictions of it and the reference points to it, that's something that doesn't come easy for me. And looking at the strengths and the influence of constitutional lodges, that too, I know that it's vitally important. I don't know where else we're going to have this kind of discussion, to be honest with you. So in Masonic order, I'll look forward to the fact that we won't, we'll move on next time. I hope that you're all doing well, that you're, the great architect is walking beside you and is a presence somehow in your thoughts and in your imagination. Until we meet again, thank you for joining me for Masonic Companion. Absolute pleasure to be here and talk with you. Remember, if you have things to add, email me to or ideas or comments to masoniccompanion@gmail.com. I'll look forward to seeing you next week.